On the KHSU Magazine today, we're talking with HSU Scholarly Communications Librarian Kyle Morgan and Dr. Charles Biles. Charles is an HSU Emeritus Professor of Mathematics and author of the latest Humboldt State University Press publication titled The History of Congressional Apportionment. He's giving a talk tomorrow on the Electoral College versus the Popular Vote, and that's going to be at 4 o'clock in the HSU Library Scholars Lab on the third floor. Thank you, Kyle and Charles, for being here today on the magazine.
Thank you very much. Yeah, very excited to have this book. So this is Humboldt State University Press's. It's their latest publication. It's just so important we have these books available in open access and freely available and accessible for sharing this really important information. And I'm really also excited about the talk that's going to be going on based on the history of congressional apportionment. The book, the talk will be the Electoral College versus the Popular Vote. There'll be snacks there. It's a Library Scholars Lab, third floor. There's going to be voting materials so you can register to vote. Should be a really good event.
Oh, it sounds fascinating and a little bit confusing, I have to say. Just studying up on the Electoral College and congressional apportionment. Dr. Biles, how does a math professor end up writing a book about the history of congressional apportionment?
What a fascinating question. That's because after retiring, a few years later, one of my grandchildren, after graduating from high school, I want to start at College of the Redwoods and wanted to talk about what was like being a college student and what to take. And as I was listening to him, I got these huge pangs of jealousy. I thought, oh, what it would be like to be 18 to 20 years old again and starting college all over again. Then I thought, wait a minute, I can do that. HSU has a great seniors program. I can take anything that I want. Well, if I went back to university, what would I take? And I thought in my own studies, I never had a course in American history. So I took a course in American history and had the great fortune of getting Professor Tom Mays in the history department for History 101. And I absolutely loved the first semester. And I continued with a couple of other courses through Professor Mays, in particular colonial and revolutionary history, and another course on the age of Jefferson to Jackson. Now, the upper division courses at HSU in history are all 4 units, 3 for lecture and 1 for a research project. And for that latter course on the age of Jefferson to Jackson, which was more Washington to Polk, I thought, I'd like to pick a topic that had something to do with math. And I had the recollection that in the liberal arts courses, the math books had a chapter on voting theory, in particular elections and the ballots. And they were just starting to bring in the topic of congressional apportionment. So I thought, congressional apportionment should be an interesting one because I wonder how the very first Congress handled congressional apportionment. The Constitution initially assigned 65 seats distributed among the 13 states, former colonies. But the Constitution also said that a reapportionment had to be made within the first 3 years of the first meeting of Congress based on a decennial census. Decennial meaning taken every 10 years. The first census was taken in 1790. So I got curious, how did the very first Congress deal with the 1790 census? And I found, there was a lot of good articles out there written by historians, mathematicians on the very first census. So I thought, this was really cool. What did they do as a result of the 1800 census? And I could not find a single article written by any historian about reapportionment based on the 1800 census.
Wow.
Similarly with the 1810 census. And I thought, wow, this is a researcher's dream, virgin territory. But I did have to go back to the original House and Senate journals and reconstruct from all the, read all the debates and all the discussions and reconstruct what happened. And after doing the initial 1790 census and then 1800 and 1810, I was absolutely smitten. I couldn't help myself. I had to continue. So that's how I got into it.
So can you tell us about congressional apportionment today? It's basically deciding how many seats the U.S. House of Representatives get for per state. So how is that determined now?
That's a wonderful question. I'm going to invite you to be if I ever go back to teaching, I want to invite you to be a student in my class.
I would love to be a student again.
Currently,
in your class.
Thank you. Currently, there are 435 seats in the U.S. House of Representatives. Why 435? 435 as the number of seats in the House was first reached in 1912, and it became frozen into law as a result of the Census Apportionment Act of 1929. So based on every decade, it's 435 seats that need to be divvied up among the states according to the population as enumerated by the decennial census. And the size of the House has remained exactly at 435 ever since, so no updates at all, except for a minor brief one. The size of the House is 435, always based on a reapportionment based on the census, as enumerated, based on the population as enumerated by the census. In 1959, Alaska and Hawaii were each given one seat until the next reapportionment was done. So that was just a brief interlude there for accommodating Alaska and Hawaii into the Union. But outside of that, it's been 435, and it's going to stay that way until Congress changes the law. Don't hold your breath.
Right.
But even leading up to, there were a lot of fights in Congress. I mean, this really defined power in the country, the number of seats, how you count those seats. It's an amazing history.
Oh, that's fabulous that you mentioned power. And that's because based on each decade, there was always a thread involved for fairness, but the opposite side of that coin was power. So always fairness and power went together. They really played a dramatic role, especially based on the 1920 census. And that's because that was the only time where no reapportionment was done. After every other census, the House was reapportioned, but not this time. What happened in 1920? Well, prohibition was in effect. And the Drys, who wanted to keep prohibition, would not yield any iota of power to the Wets, who wanted to repeal prohibition. There were kind of two main things going on. Based on reapportionment from the census, there were always those that wanted to decrease the size of the House. The House is too rowdy and unwieldy, and we can't get anything done, and people are always bickering and fighting. Then there were those that wanted to increase the size of the House because the population of the country was increasing, so more people needed more representation. So it was always a push and pull between fairness and power as to how to distribute the seats in the House.
So as far as the Electoral College, which you're going to be discussing tomorrow, that's based on population, but not quite. I mean, there's the fairness and power differential that comes into place, right? So some of the less populated states, they actually have, votes that would, they have a number of electoral votes that might be of more than what's really represented by their percentage of their population, right? Is that correct?
That is correct. The United States has a very uniquely American way of selecting its president. The people do not elect the president directly. The people elect electors who then elect the president.
Right. Our founding fathers didn't trust the American public to actually vote. It's such a strange thing, right?
It was a very strange thing.
So I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Oh, no, that's totally okay. Please do.
So it's the Electoral College that votes on the president, actually. So how do you decide, how is it decided how many electoral votes each state gets?
That's a great question. There's a formula in the Constitution about the size of the Electoral College. It's the number of national legislatures. So number of national legislators. So you take the number of seats in the House, which is 435, and then add together the number of senators, Each state has two senators. There are 50 states, so there's 100 senators altogether. 435 in the House plus 100 in the Senate makes 535. And the 23rd Amendment to the U.S. Constitution elevates Washington, D.C. to the status of an electoral state. Notice it's not an official one of
right,
the 50 states.
They get three votes
and they
like
get three
the 60s,
electoral votes.
Right?
That's correct.
So, in the last presidential election, we really, and I guess there's been quite a few in this millennia, where the popular vote did not reflect the final vote of the Electoral College, and those are kind of hard pills to swallow. We need to go out and vote and make our voices heard, but in this case, it didn't really quite play out that way. It was more based on this arcane sort of system. Do you think that the Electoral College needs to continue to exist? Yes or no?
That's a great question. And I'm going to do the academic answer of yes and no.
Oh, no.
I know. Isn't that just terrible? In an academic role, what I'd like to do is to describe what the situation is, give facts, but let people make up their own minds. That is, my whole purpose is not to go on a platform or preach to a particular agenda. In an academic setting, one of the things we like to develop is analytic thinking, where we'll give you the facts. I would like to hear the audience's opinion, and then let's put all those opinions together, and collective learning usually is a better thing than having the speaker pontificate.
Right.
So I'm not going to give a yes or no answer.
Okay. Does the general public of the United States need to be protected from itself, from just having one person, one vote actually be counted? Are we not to mm-hmm. be trusted with that power?
That's a great point that you brought up, one person, one vote. A key important component of any election is fairness. And of course, the million-dollar question is, what does it mean to be fair? As a result of the history from this country as to what it means to be fair, fairness has primarily been distilled into the notion of one person, one vote. Now, looking on the national level, at the same time, while thinking of fairness, I also like to think of the preamble to the U.S. Constitution. And the preamble begins, "We, the people of the United States." And I think that's the most beautiful beginning to any political document ever written in the history of mankind. But "we, the people of the United States" is still an ideal. When we look at national offices, the U.S. House of Representatives, representatives are elected in a congressional district. The idea of one person, one vote stops at the congressional district boundaries because other people outside the boundary don't get to vote for that particular representative. So a member of the U.S. House of Representatives is voted into office by the voters of a particular congressional district. When it comes to the U.S. Senate, a senator represents states. And a person voting for a senator, it's again one person, one vote, but that stops at the state line. There is not a single national office where one person, one vote extends to the entire nation. When it comes to voting for president, this is really a key thing here. On National Election Day, which was November 10th, and you went to the polls and you maybe thought you were voting for president, you weren't voting for president at all. You were voting in a statewide election for that state to select its slate of electors.
Well, thank you. So I'm so sorry that we can't continue on this conversation, but you can absolutely have this conversation tomorrow with Dr. Charles Biles. And Kyle Morgan, you put this event together. Will you tell us really super quickly about the event tomorrow and where people can download a free copy of this book?
Sure. So tomorrow it's an event put on by the library, HSU Press, and the Department of Politics here on campus. It's open from 4 to 5. It should be a really great intellectually stimulating conversation with time to talk personally with Dr. Charles Biles here about the Electoral College and the popular vote. You can get the book at HSU Press. That's at Digital Commons at Humboldt State University. And you can download a copy free and see what you think yourself. It's a great old book.
That's right. Thank you so much for coming. Thanks for your wonderful research. And I hope you have a great turnout tomorrow.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks.